Information Magazine tells us every day computers are making people easier to use. This time on the Plutopia podcast, Brian Magee and Paulina Borsuk accept part of the blame for the publication the New York Times called The Anti-Wired. Information takes aim at many obvious and not-so-obvious tech targets: smartphones, automotive tech, surveillance tech, and tech bros.
It's funny how much more mainstream the term tech bro is today, as a joke even. And, you know, that I think, you know, we did this piece, Paulina and I did this piece in the last issue, in the second issue about the, was it the second or the first, Paulina?
I think it was the second, and that was Silicon Valley Alpha Males.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, the tech bro one is clearly a descendant of that. And you and I were vastly amused by what we did with the Alpha Males one, but it was very inside Silicon Valley, you know, like a lot of, I mean, you can go back and read it, and it's held up pretty well, but it's like, you have to have been there at the time to understand why it was perfect in its small way. Whereas the tech bro thing has become so, everyone knows about them and everyone talks about them. And I don't know what else to say about that, so.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, and joining me today are my co-hosts, Scoop Sweeney, my partner at Plutopia, and Wendy Grossman, our other co-host. And then we have a couple of guests today that are just going to be delightful. I can promise you that. I should say that we're going to be talking about issue number 3 of Information Magazine, which has a tagline, "Every day computers are making people easier to use." And it's kind of a cult magazine about what tech is doing to us. The first couple of issues were published back around 2000, you know, when all this stuff was overheated. And now it's overheated again. So they've published a third issue that's slick, beautiful, cranky, hilarious, and it weighs about a pound and a half. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice, big, substantial magazine. Paulina is a writer who's been covering cyberspace. Paulina Borsuk is a writer who's been covering cyberspace since its earliest days. She worked on the first couple of issues of Information back in the day, back at the turn of the century. And she's a contributing editor now on issue number 3. She's also written extensively about digital culture, and she's written especially about Silicon Valley, cypherpunks, bionomics, and techno-libertarianism. Man, she got into that. She wrote a book called Cyber Selfish, a critical romp through the terribly libertarian culture of high tech, which was published back in 2000 and got a lot of people excited. And it was based on an essay she had written in 1996, which also got a lot of people excited. And Brian Magee is Information Magazine's humor editor. He's a webmaster. He's the shipping department and social chairman. He worked at Apple on iconic and not so iconic products, including the Newton and the iMac. His biggest claim is inventing the email spam filter with Postini, thus giving the world the greatest excuse for not reading our mother's email. His current business is Showmentum, where he wholesales comedy experiences. And Brian, I hope I got your surname right.
Close enough.
Tell me. Magee. Okay.
Magee. I get my okay. I've had every form of it. But never Magee.
I have a name like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my first question, just to get things started, is how did you get HAL 9000 to pose for the cover of the magazine?
He hasn't worked in a long time, so he was happy to get the exposure.
You know, John, did you know it was HAL 9000 when you saw the cover?
I did.
Okay, because I some people immediately recognize it, and other people go, "Oh, well, it looks like a camera lens, but I don't really know what it is." So I just didn't know how good the recognition was of it.
Well, it's not just HAL 9000, but it's HAL 9000 made up to look like a contemporary AI. He's got those sparkles, you know?
Yeah, because I think a lot of people associate HAL 9000 with this kind of, without the stars on it, and just kind of this kind of eye.
Yeah. Well, and just in case anyone's listening from a legal department, it's HAL 9003, not the one in the movie. That I'm not even sure what that would be, right? We wouldn't want to bring that up.
Well, I don't think they could stop you from making your own knockoff.
No, exactly. We've all been, into, fair use, or, we constantly get people asking, like, is that, can you get away with stuff like that? And we're like, well,
look at this.
Find us, people would have to read it. We'd have to have a big enough audience to be worth suing.
If you see what I'm holding up, this is our copy of Fringewear Review, where we put Captain Crunch on it. And we did consult an attorney on this, and he said it was okay. It was parody.
Yep.
And incidentally, right now, if anybody else has one, you can hold it up too. This is the magazine information. It's a little heavy. It's a little hard to lift, but I've got it here. Okay. And that magazine is available pretty much anywhere, right?
Soon. It's available on the web, which makes it available just about anywhere in the U.S. We are selling it in several countries, Europe and Australia, soon to be in a major book retailer. I don't know. Where are we at on that, Helena?
On Barnes & Noble? I think it's the first week in October.
Openly.
It'll be in, like...
I think October 7th is the day.
Yeah. It'll be in Barnes & Noble stores across the country. It's starting October 7th. So that's really great. And then it's available, I guess, in Europe through Mag Culture, which is a magazine store in London. So
I dropped a box off to ship... they sold out of the first run, and now they're getting some more, not a lot, but they're getting, Mag Culture will be one place to get it in the UK to save on shipping. I mean,
when you get inquiries, I see you get inquiries from Norway and stuff. Do you point them towards Mag Culture, or do you ship it from California to Norway? And what do you do when a European wants to buy it? What do you?
Well, it's a three-stage process. If a European buys it and already pays for shipping, then I field the complaints on how much the shipping cost.
Yeah, right.
and then others, people have asked, like, do you ship to this country? And I usually interact with them and say, if we don't, I'll warn them what the shipping cost may be, and I'll look it up, and we'll tend to ship it to that country and add it to our list. But then if they are UK or whatever, I'll let them know about Mag Culture. There's the distribution team has been handling both of those questions. So I just kind of hand people off to that and see what we can do.
Who's going to be in charge of handling the complaints from the tech bros and the threats?
You're talking to the two people that started it. So, or the ones who, Pauline and I wrote that piece. So fire away.
Now, I was going to ask if you shipped to Eswatini.
No.
You know where Eswatini is? I never heard of it until just the other day. That's where they're sending Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
Yeah.
It's apparently a country in Africa.
Like Burkina Faso?
Yeah.
Well,
anyway.
He needs something to read. I'll definitely get him an issue.
That's what I was thinking. So I mean, we kind of know the answer to this because we've been looking at the magazine, but this is an important question to ask. What core question or theme anchors this new issue, and how did that shape the criteria for what went in and what didn't go in?
Just like be entertaining. I don't know if it was beyond that. And don't be stale. I don't know. What would you say, Brian?
I would agree. I don't think we were trying to be on a high horse or on a soapbox of any kind. I think we're all painfully aware of what comes with taking that kind of position on stuff. But also, we knew we were at least a year away from getting it out. So we also want to make sure we were getting stuff that had a decent shelf life. And so, some of these topics just they're important enough and to cover and try to keep some sense of their, that these are evergreen problems to some extent. So yeah, I mean, we did have some rules of thumb all around, was like certain stuff were just like that. These things seem like they're already covered. This is the kind of stuff that gets covered by, blogs, or this is the kind of thing that's getting covered by television news and things like that. And I also think, when it came to the humor part, we were really concerned about kind of rewarding the people that know what's going on. I would say some of the jokes, many of the jokes in the magazine are kind of inside baseball. We lean into that a little bit. And, again, speaking from the humor point of view on the magazine, one of the things Pauline and I, we had talked about this, where it's like, sometimes people go, "I don't get it." And I'm like, "Well, everybody doesn't have to." When it comes to humor, I think there's kind of like three types of audiences. There's people that are so obtuse they won't get it and they don't want to. They're not, I would call them humorless. And then you have the other people who are kind of like, "I think I should know what this is. I kind of know, I'm culturally literate. I should get this joke, and I'm compelled to kind of find out why it's funny." And then there's the third, where it's like you're in, and if like I use an example of one that was a little bit on the bubble with people, was the Scrum Master movie poster. That one, I mean, if you understand, or if you've ever been subjected to the torture and hell of agile methodology, if you know, and that's one where we're like, we really want to reward people who get the joke and feel that there's a certain amount of delight in knowing something, especially if it's a little bit of an inside joke, and not to be snobs, but to be like, hey, I get that joke. I've seen this. I mean, even the tech bros thing is, it's funny how much more mainstream the term tech bro is today as a joke, even. And, that I think, we did this piece, Paulina and I did this piece in the last issue, in the second issue, about the, was it the second or the first, Paulina? It was
I think
the,
it was the second, and that was Silicon Valley Alpha Males. Yeah, and the tech bro one is clearly a descendant of that. And you and I were vastly amused by what we did with the Alpha Males one, but it was very inside Silicon Valley. Like a lot of, I mean, you can go back and read it, and it's held up pretty well. But it's like you have to have been there at the time to understand why it was perfect in its small way. Whereas the tech bro thing has become so. Everyone knows about them and everyone talks about them. And yeah, I don't know what else to say about them. So.
There's a lot of stuff too about Silicon Valley and technology that is done to death, and that we really want to avoid. I mean, we all get, I mean, stupid job titles are, or there's all this kind of humor I feel from people that don't really know. It's almost like, there's some jokes that are just made all the time about, like people that like to take pride in not being very technical and stuff like that. And like the tech bros one, the joke there being that the there's all kinds of things. The look evolved, and the job titles went from something sensible that meant something to these just absurd,
And they're all real job titles in that.
Yeah, there's that too.
That to me is sort of the meta aspect of that. Those job titles are real. And we weren't going to say that explicitly, but I suspect some people looking at it would get that those were real job titles. I mean, the one that was most outrageous was the retro bio guy, the one that was, it's like when I found that, I sent it to Temkin and he said, "Oh, that can't be a real job title." And I said, "Yes, it is. Let me send you the pointer." And then he was like, "Oh my God, all right, we got to have it." So,
I
aren't you?
saw something the other day on LinkedIn that it was a job opening called Head of CEO Content. And like they're not even dressing it up. It's such a stupid job title. And I couldn't resist just going in and, being a jerk and saying, one, like the job and the publicity around, the whole thing of like, this job's gonna pay $1 million and blah, and all the hype around it. And I couldn't help but say, like, this job is, is it content or content? Like, is your job is to be in charge of keeping the CEO happy? But it was basically a ghostwriter job. And it seemed to me like if your job is to write all the CEO stuff and make sense of what the business does, it's your company. You're this, you know what I mean? Like we're literally hiring a CEO to do the CEO's job, but we're not going to call him that, So it's a, it, there's so much like tech fart sniffing that, I mean, the material just writes itself in some ways, you know.
I was thinking about Team Human. Well, if you know what I'm talking about, you know, Doug Rushkoff has this thing where he talks about being on Team Human and how, you know, we have to remember to be human beings. Technology cannot dominate us and that sort of thing. And I think it's important that we're laughing our asses off at the weird quirks of this technology. Which makes me also think about the big meeting that Trump had the other day with all the tech people sitting around, and they were all basically waxing sycophantic with Donald Trump. And I was, I mean, I laughed. A lot of people were like tearing their hair out and worried and concerned, and but I thought that was kind of a joke.
Well, they're shameless too. I mean, what did you expect these people to do? I don't mean, I've been in this industry a long time, and you know, I remember when Tim Cook came to Apple back in the 90s and salaries had been frozen, pay had been cut. We were going down the shitter and everybody, you know, was counting us out and all that stuff. And along comes this guy who'd maybe worked somewhere like, I don't know, 8 months at Compaq or whatever. And so, you know, he came to Apple and everybody, they made it. I remember the press releases and stuff. And I'm like, you know, we were still like a Fortune 50 company, even though we weren't doing well. And so I don't understand people acting like, you know, this was such a risky job when he came in making six digits and not having to do anything. And I guess I'm being personal here, but that crowd, I mean, like it's a whole new wave of people that just are, I don't know. I mean, it's like carpetbaggers, you know what I mean? That the industry's been kind of full of miscreants and misanthropes who are very humorless, but think they're funny or think they're clever or whatever. And it's, I feel like it's like high school, right? You know, when I was always the guy that sat in the back of the class that would make a smart ass comment, and the other guy would say it out loud and get the laugh, and I'd be kind of like, hey, you know, like that was my joke. And when I say stuff like that, I always get in trouble with the teachers.
Yeah, I mean
So,
they're funny, but not for the reasons they think they're funny.
right.
Yeah.
They're dorks.
Well, I and I really appreciate the humor in the magazine, and the fact that it does have a kind of like insider feel to it. But there is that question, the obvious question about whether, you know, as you distribute the magazine out far and wide, will there be a lot of people who will just be baffled by some of the stuff in it?
But you know what I think we say about the magazine is like there's kind of something for everybody. You don't have to read every piece, you don't have to like every piece. You know, it's kind of it's a true magazine in that way. It's a, you know, it's not uniform. You know, it's not like reading, I always say, foreign policy. You know, it's just sort of, yeah, you know, if this appeals to you, fine. If you don't get that one, fine. What that I think is one of the beauties of having so much art in it, you know, the graphic novel, the photo essays. You know, you don't want to read anything, fine, just look at the pictures. You know, and anyone that is accessible to anybody. So in that sense, you know, I think it's a magazine for, oh, and this is also what an old-fashioned magazine needs to be. In our early editorial meetings, I was droning on about this, which is like magazines from like the 60s and the 70s, particularly Esquire, were like this. You never knew what you were going to get one page to the next. Was it going to be humor? Was it going to be art? Was it be serious investigative reporting? You didn't know, but you knew because of the kind of goodness of the editorial vision, you know, it would be worth reading. And that's how I think of this magazine. It's like, you know, it's not at all uniform in terms of tone, which I think is a good thing, except that, you know, nothing's going to be a dud. I'll just put it that way.
Details was like that for a while. I remember in the early 90s where it was a magazine. It was kind of a style magazine, but it had some genuinely funny stuff in it. Spin was another magazine I remember coming out in the 80s, which was kind of the antidote to Rolling Stone. And I was a huge fan of Spy
Oh, I
magazine
love Spy. Yes, Spy
back
was great.
ago. And
And I
David
didn't get
Kemp.
half the jokes in Spy either because I wasn't one of these New York Insider kids, but I didn't care. I just thought, oh, this is fun to read, so I don't care. Yeah, I think that's Also, I want to give a lot of credit to David because what I would see about him, he was very allowing, very supportive. He let everyone go off and do whatever they wanted to do. But every once in a while, he'd step in and go, nah, it's got to be like this, or nah, it's got to be like that, which is, any good artistic object has to have that person, the director on the movie, the editor at the publishing house. In other words, in that sense, it's got his stamp and that he had a good sense of what would fly and what wouldn't. So I think that's important. And it's an invisible hand thing, but I think it's really important.
And that's David Temkin.
Yes. Who's our fearless leader.
Yeah, the magazine is a lot of David, a lot of what it is. And I've known David for over 30 years now. And we've done two startups together. So I've spent a lot of time with David Temkin, probably more than anybody else on this team, other than his wife.
I was thrilled by the fact that you're engaging in what has been termed dead media. I've read so many articles about the death of print, the death of magazines, the death of analog. And I enjoy tormenting John about my thrill of being an analog fan. I have loads of analog technology just because I worked so long in digital. I just needed something that wasn't bits and bytes. And so I have tons of analog magazines, vinyl records, reel-to-reel tape, just st stuff. Because in a previous lifetime, I was a radio reporter in San Francisco for a news service there, and that died right along when digital became a thing. So I enjoyed the take on that you did on pre and post iPhone. And that segment, that when I read that, I really identified with that. How did you come to pick on the iPhone?
Well, it's hard to avoid its impact on the world. It doesn't hurt that we know Jeremy Wilde too, the person in the article. He's actually a good friend of mine, and David and I both know him. We've actually done two startups with him. But it's such an inescapable thing. I mean, you could it's the root of all good and evil, like the last almost it's weird too, because it's I was just reading about, I'm reading Kara Swisher's book, and she's talking about like the iPhone, and just thinking about it came out in 2007, and I'm like, oh my God, it's almost 20 years old. And it's almost like I can't believe how much I feel like the iPhone is compressed time, that, 5 years ago we were talking about the pandemic, and now we're, supposedly on the other side of it. But, the iPhone too, it just seems like it's, it's I'm if you're hearing people talk today about like people, it's so funny that people are talking about missing, they'd like to go back to a flip phone, which is funny. It's like I remember when flip phones were all the, it was quite the when the StarTAC was the iPhone of its day as a status symbol.
I think also David's point, and I think we'll all agree with that, is that there are things you could do in a magazine that you can't do on a website. And there's a kind of flipping the pages and a kind of depth reading. And I think we all understand that. And every time I've shown the magazine to someone, their eyes kind of light up. They're so delighted to be handed a physical object, which is beautiful. But, the physicality, I think, like they've kind of forgotten that that's what they were missing, if that makes sense.
Who decided to make it like really slick and really kind of heavy quality paper and all that?
I think that was
Was that strategic?
David and I think the art director. I think the decision was made to go with a really gorgeous, high quality, beautifully preserved, produced professional object. And I think there was that I think David and Josh, the big cheese art director, I think they went to Denver where the printer is in what last winter to pick out the paper and stuff. I just think it was sort of like, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this the right way. It's not going to look like a zine. One of the ways I talk about the magazine, it's kind of like a coffee table book. It's something you want to keep around, flip through, people come over for dinner that they want to look at. And so you want to bring those qualities of, I would say, permanence and good production values to it. I don't know. Does that make sense to you, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, just one of the things we really didn't want anybody to do is mistake it for a zine, right? And dismiss it outright. Just be like, aha, look at these tech wonks or, whatever. Like we're stapling this thing together and going to Kinko's. But I like David's response, which is just as good today as it was 25 years ago when people would bring it up in kind of a smug way, like, why a magazine? Why not a website? As if like this whole team didn't know that the web existed. And I like David's response is, would you be talking to us if this was a website?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when you first handed me a copy of the magazine, the first thing that came into my mind, I started thinking about industry standard. And I was remembering how industry standard grew over throughout the like dot-com boom. That thing just got thicker and thicker and thicker till it was heavier than this thing is,
Yeah,
at
no
one
one.
point. And
Yeah.
then it started shrinking again. And you could use it as a metric, basically.
One of the
But
stories,
yeah.
yeah, one of the concepts we had for issue, the old ideas for issue three was like a cat. I had pitched was like a Dr. Seuss type, bit about like the impending layoffs of like, they took their Aerons and their Boofus and their Goof, like the whole like a Grinch take on the bu when the bubble burst. Because I used to tell people the sign that your company's going under is there's only like Diet Sprite in the fridge, and they tell you to take, people that never travel have to stop taking like non-essential travel, and the photocopiers disappear, just weird business things like that.
That happened even in very large companies. I remember some friends at Bell Labs telling me about the day that Bell Labs announced that it wasn't going to be bottled water anymore. And it kicked off an exodus, I believe.
There'll be corporate jets. Don't worry about that. They'll still be flying, but the bottled water, that's going to make the difference.
Well, when you take it away from your big re your top researchers, it's pretty much a sign that you're going the wrong way. I'm sort of, I mean, I hate to be crass and ask this, but what is the business model of this magazine?
The
The
business
three
model
issues over
is David
25 years.
Mitkin funding it, basically. There's no business model. I mean, it's like he is the old-fashioned sort of philanthropic publisher. I mean, there used to be a lot of those kind of people in New York publishing, maybe the first half of the century. They had certain kinds of deep po pockets. They would publish the stuff they believed in.
I think that's how the New Yorker got started. The story, as I understand it, is that Harold Ross, the first editor, was, used to hang out with the Algonquin wits, Georges Kaufman and Dorothy Parker and all those guys at the Algonquin having lunch. And he kept talking about this magazine he wanted to found, and one day he found somebody to fund it.
Well, in this case, it was David. So, it's an incredibly generous thing for him to have done in so many ways. And Brian, maybe you know this better than I do. When he quit Google, whenever it was, a little more than 2 years ago, I don't know if when he quit Google, he decided, all right, let's do issue number three, or if he decided, I'm out of here. And then he sat around and thought, maybe we should. In other words, was there a causal link between issue number three and his leaving Google, or they weren't related? I don't know.
I'd have to ask David, but I don't think they're related. I just remember getting the call. I mean, I remember my very first conversation with David about the magazine, and even he and I have disputes about this that back in 1993, I think it was, we were talking about, and he had said to me, I had this idea and called, and he had said information. This is my memory of it. It could be wrong. But I don't think so. Because I remember being at the Fairmont Hotel in San Jose because I was in town for the Apple for Apple Developer Conference. But his back then he was saying, it should be on the net. And that was, we used to use terms like that in 1993. The web hadn't really appeared to the general public. And then later, 96-ish, 97-ish, when we started to actually work on the magazine in earnest, it went from being like definitely not on the net, let's make a magazine. And that was, and that's when I met all the other folks like Oren and Alex and Tony and some of the people that worked on the first issue. But the business model, we used to get those questions back then too, like, what are you thinking putting a magazine out? And for some people, I'm like, well, do you read magazines? No, don't worry about it, And I think today, I mean, there's a bunch of us who really like working on this. We've really I hate to say words like this, but I mean, we have built a brand. I mean, this thing really does stand for something, and it does have a personality and a point of view. And I personally would like to see it go further. It doesn't, as a magazine, who knows how we do it, but I think as a media property, I think there's something there. I think the world wants to see this and hear this. I mean, it doesn't ha I'm not a guy that believes the world, like everybody, the world is not my addressable market for a lot of things. There's plenty of underserved people out there wanting something better, and information is for those folks, and
One of the things I think of with the magazine, there are two things, which is I think there's an audience of people who are starved for something which is critical, even in a funny way or a serious way, about what's going on with tech culture. And I think there's an audience of people who have things to say or that they want to create, and they had no place to do it. So, I think it was a really big unmet need. And I don't think it's a coincidence that John, I don't know if we mentioned this to you, but this BBC tech reporter who lives in, actually lives in the East Bay in Albany. She talked about it in, she sends out a weekly newsletter about technology and stuff. And she talked about the magazine, but what she really latched onto was the humor pieces. And I think it's because probably as a tech reporter, she is so starved for something that is funny, knowing, doesn't take these people seriously. I mean, I really think that's why she, not that the humor isn't good, but I really think that that's why she latched onto it. It was such an antidote to the stuff that she, the press releases she has to wade through and all the rest of the stuff. And I think there's a big underserved community of both contributors and readers for this kind of stuff. I am sometimes amused when people now are approaching a magazine who want to write for it, and we kind of look at who they are, what they're doing, and it's like, eh, I don't think so. I mean, they want to write some serious, obvious marketing piece about what AI can do for you. And it's like, eh, I don't think that fits with what we do, but they don't kind of understand.
Well, typically in the magazine business, you sell ads, to, I mean, that's your big source of money. The magazine is sort of a way to deliver ads to people, but with one exception, the ads in the magazine aren't real. So that business model seems like it's kind of out the window. So if you were really going to make money with this thing, the question is whether you would start running real ads or not.
Okay, but let me ask you a serious question. What company would want to have its ads in our magazine?
I don't know. There'd probably be a few.
You
You could
think?
do. You remember when we did Fringewear Review? We had a catalog in the back. We were just selling all kinds of stuff from a catalog, but it was stuff that we were selling. We were like, I mean, we originally started to have a mail order catalog, and then it turned into a zine instead, and it was kind of a magazine. I mean, we used heavier paper. We had, it was a little higher quality stuff. And it had a similar attitude, actually. I don't know what would have happened with that magazine if we had tried to sell ads, because the business model there was basically a catalog model.
Yeah,
I'm not an
companies are so nervous these days and humorless. I can't
yeah.
see. I mean, it was great that we got that tequila ad on the back. That was really great. But, I'm trying to imagine the company that would feel comfortable being in a, it's not just humor, but a humor magazine with other stuff. I can't imagine these days what company would feel comfortable being there. They'd be too afraid of, I don't know. You know what I'm
Well,
trying
you're
to say.
right. Everybody's scared shitless right now, right?
That's right.
Afraid,
Like
and they're
stockholder
afraid.
revolt, or they get offended, or whatever it is. I just can't. I can't see it. But
Well, I think.
afraid to be real.
Well, I'm not an ad sales guy, and I think that, there's some things I think, like for instance, alcohol ads would probably work fine. I mean, we're all very fond of alcohol. So we don't have any moral problems with it. But the and those tend to those people those businesses tend to spend a lot of money, because that's all it is, right? Is booze, but then they add advertising, they can charge more. But the one thing I would be concerned about, like too, with advertising is, I don't know, it's like the William Shatner effect. Like, it stopped being funny when William Shatner got in on the joke. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't want these people that are like, they'll want to, like, there's nothing more cloying to me than like a brand thinking they're funny. I've seen this in The Onion, this happening and stuff like that, where it's like, hey, let us, we got some copywriters here who, might be able to, and it's like, don't try to blend in, just be the ad, give us the check and shut up. And that would be our pitch deck. And I don't know how well that would go. I mean,
You
there's
know,
definitely
one of
the,
the advanced readers of this magazine, who I won't name, when he was first looking at the magazine, he was confused because he thought the ads were real. And he said, "You don't have that many ads." And I
oh
was thinking, "They're all jokes. They're all jokes, except for the one on the back cover." You know,
Did they name any of them ones they thought were real?
he thought all of them were. So, I'm not going to name his name, but yeah, I was thinking, wow. That's interesting. Should we talk about what's going on with Google, Brian, or should we not talk about that?
I don't have the real, I mean, I'm not even sure what it is going on with it, other than,
Now I was okay. This is an inside baseball thing, but there's something very strange going on, which is if you try to search for the magazine, which is informationmagazine.com, information magazine, you try to search for it in Google, you cannot find it. If you use other search engines, you can find it just fine. Google is. We don't know what they're doing. Are they suppressing it? Do they think we're trying to siphon off, traffic from the information magazine? It's not really clear. And given that David used to work at Google and knows a lot of people there, and the staff of the magazine are very technically savvy, and no one can figure out what's going on, we all find it very suspect. So
Well, I'm getting hits when I search for it, but I did notice that the actual website for the magazine is not in the search results.
What kind of search results come up for the magazine?
I get
Yeah, other stuff.
people who are mentioning it, like, what is that, Mag Culture or whatever it is in the UK that's selling it, that kind of thing. I
Okay.
mean,
Wikipedia
there
comes
are,
up.
yeah,
Yeah.
Wikipedia.
And they have a link to your website. That's the only way I found your website.
Well, that's
Exactly.
because David, with great foresight before the magazine came out, decided, damn it, we're not showing up on Google. We need a Wikipedia entry. So he was clever enough to do that. It's just very odd, and no one at Google will fess up to anything, and none of the really smart tech people in Barbara the magazine can figure it out. So it's very fishy. So.
I tend to think, I mean, it's like Occam's razor here, though. I think the simplest explanation will probably be it. What I'm wondering, though, what I'd like to hear from people are simple explanations or other theories. Because I'm not inclined to think it's, I imagine it's probably, oh, that makes sense, or something like that'll come up. Because, I mean, I've been doing web development since it was a thing. I mean, going back to, I mean, a long time. And as long, almost as long as you possibly could do it. And I've stood up so many websites, pre-Google, whatever, and even ones that get like no traffic, no interest or anything like that, still show up on Google sooner or later. So what's been frustrating for me is that, like, David constantly asking me, like, what I'm like, out of the box, it's a WordPress website, it's not that complicated, like, out of the box, they're, they'll Google will find it, Google finds stuff that I don't want to be on the web.
Yeah, so it's very late.
Yeah.
And the website's been up, what, 3 months, 4 months at this point?
Yeah,
It
and
is
it's
kind of, I mean,
hardly,
it.
stirring the pot. If you look at it, it's pretty boring. So I don't know.
Well, people keep talking about how terrible Google search has become. Maybe it's just that Google search is not what it used to be.
That's another one, right? It's always trying to shovel out the AI stuff.
Well, that's
I
certainly true.
mean,
Google search. I've divorced Google in 2010, but
Yeah.
on the rare occasion that I go and look at it, it seems to have really deteriorated.
David, I feel like
Has,
you and
but
I,
yeah.
our luck varies. I mean, I would not consider myself an unlucky person, but like when David and I did a startup 10 years ago called Cola, and this product, we had done a really good job of lining up the press. We had done a really good job of getting the product. We did what I would say, like, technically, tactically, steps. We did everything right. And then the day it launched, it goes on Apple's web store. It's called Cola, COLA, Cola Messenger, all this stuff. And even if you literally typed in COLA, 40 other results would come up, way collab, all everything, but not the, even if you just typed the four letters, and it still didn't come up on like the first, page or whatever searches in the App Store. And it was just like, Jesus, this is another one of those moments. And then, and you talk to Apple, and it would be like, no, what do you know? It's I mean, this really speaks more to like not something sinister as much as like the gross incompetency that results in having big behemoths like this, where it is kind of like, I mean, you know, their response to all this stuff is like, well, you know how it go, you know, you must have done something wrong, you know, and you know the machine works the way it's supposed to, and you know that's probably, you know, another one of these things with Google, like, you know, one of their don't be evil things, just they forgot to turn off the don't, you know, like when it is in, if it isn't evil, if the other guy isn't evil, we forgot to, you know, look out for them. I don't know.
Well, when I use Chrome for anything, I try to avoid it, but sometimes I can't. And it seems to all be AI now. It's not really Google search; it's Google AI. We're going to tell you what we feel about it, and it's pretty creepy.
Well, look at us, like 10 years from now, we're all going to be like looking back on the good old days of a search result. You know what I mean? Like I miss my flip phone and I miss my 10, my one page of 10 search results.
I miss AltaVista.
Oh gosh, Alta Vista, sure.
I do not miss Alta Vista. It was so cluttered by the end, it was unusable.
I mean, Alta Vista was like, as far as I know, wasn't that about like the first search engine?
Yeah,
No,
Other than
not
things
even
like
close.
Waze. Oh, really? Who preceded it?
Hotwired was certainly Yahoo was well, Yahoo was more of a directory at that time,
Yeah. I
but
mean,
no,
I.
there were
Waze.
a whole bunch before AltaVista. It was just that AltaVista was the best of them in around 1995,
It was the
96.
fast one.
Yeah. That, yeah, it
And then
was.
it started getting more and more cluttered with crap, and then Google came along with this empty white screen, and everybody sighed with relief and ran to it, you know?
And they
Yeah.
included a Boolean search criteria, which I hadn't had to use since college math. So it's like, okay. And
I
it
know, but you
supposed to
know,
work.
what
Yeah.
was
And there
great
was
about
all
that
kinds
was
of
you could
searches.
exclude something. I mean, I wish every search engine, you know, you go to a catalog store and you want to exclude like whole categories of stuff that you're never, I never want to look at pet food. But you can't go to a grocery site and exclude and say, never show me pet food. You can only look, it's only inclusion that you can specify. It's one of the most frustrating things about search the way it's done for me.
Well, I mean, I have this. I mean, there's so many people in the software business right now that don't belong in it. But I mean, you think of a lot of those decisions. I feel like I've been in the room where people are, you know, like such as yourself would say something like this. Just if you had a mindset that we're making a good product that people want, there are people in that room whose job it is to tell you that they don't care. You know, like that is tough. You know, that, you know, I've worked on a lot of. I joke. I mean, I've worked on a lot of projects in my career, and I said the number one problem in e-commerce I hear from clients is not enough people are buying our shit. And like, and you're like, well, that's not a usability problem. Oh, but it is. You know, you're like, all right,
Well,
well.
sometimes it is. I mean, the biggest reason I walk away from an e-commerce site is it's the first time I've been there and they want me to make an account before they'll even
Yeah,
show me the
right.
price of something. I mean, that's it. You know, I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah. I
So
see
what
it.
do you guys
I smell a bit here, Paulina. We could have like the reverse, you know, reverse focus group.
think about enshittification?
Yeah. Well, that's a good word for it. I used to call it dickonomics, but I think
I
enshittification
mean, that's kind of what we're
is a
talking
better.
about. Yeah.
You know, one
I
thing about
think.
I've already said this, but I want to say it another way is that, you know, I was a charge subscriber to Process World, and obviously information is Process World is the cranky maiden aunt of information. And you know, I know Chris Carlson, and you know, I had a long relationship with that magazine. But one of the things that was a revelation to me about it, which is also true about information, is I thought there are all these smart, creative people who are stuck working in these what we used to call data processing jobs, and they have no outlet for their other skills or their insights about all this stuff. And I think that's a really important aspect of the magazine. It's like no place else to go. Let's write it for information or create it for information. I mean, I just sort of felt there was so much kind of creative energy bursting out of the magazine and people wanted to contribute. It's like, yes, where can I do this? And where else could I do this?
Well, I mean, that's why we had blogs, right? Because we had a lot of people who were, they were pretty creative, and they had been building technology, and they had built content management systems. And the idea was that the internet was going to be this huge deal. And then suddenly there's this thing they call the dot-com bust, and there's no money
but
for anything anymore.
But there's such a big difference there, because this is a magazine that has been copy edited. It has clear formal properties to it. It's not just DIY.
Black. Well, yeah, I mean, I wasn't really referring to that piece of it, but I'm just saying that you have a lot of people who are kind of set loose and they don't know what to do with their skills. So they just put them to work, you know, and they put them to work in something that doesn't necessarily generate an income.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was kind of famous throughout my career for doing things because I thought they would be fun to do or cool to do and not even thinking about the money. Go ahead.
I think what you're saying, John, I think speaks a lot to the, when we get asked why we did this thing, is there's the motivation. And there are people out there that don't understand this type of motivation. I saw this a lot with the first couple issues where people were just like, why did you do this? And especially before they saw the magazine, they would be like, you know, and I would tell people, I would tease the article idea. Like, I remember the piece I did in the second issue called The Million Manager March. And that came, I mean, the joke was a little bit off the Million Man March, which, if you remember, was supposed to be like a million African-American men coming to DC. And I wasn't trying to make fun of that. I was really trying to make fun of the idea of, you know, like, what about us? You know what I mean? It's almost like the, you know, all lives matter response to Black Lives Matter. But I would tease people with those ideas, and people would be like, that's funny. And then I'm like, yeah, we're putting it in a magazine. And they if they got the joke, they'd be like, oh, that's good, because I get why you want to share that joke and you want to get reach, and a magazine will do it. Other people would just have this kind of like, why are you doing that? Why do you do anything? You know what I mean? And it's like, well, then they usually have jobs like business development director at, yeah, you know, blah, blah, blah. And their job is doing kind of nothing. You're only motivated by money or status or whatever. And if you're creative,
yeah, I think David
person,
was saying this time around, there was some PR person he knew in Marin, I don't know who it was, and he talked to him or her about,
oh, I know he's talking about it. It's actually a friend of mine. Yeah.
Okay. Right. And the person was totally baffled. Like, what, you know, the whole idea sounds pretentious, but art for art's sake, we're just doing it because we can and we should, and it's fun. And we have something to contribute to the zeitgeist, whatever it is, why people want to create stuff. He just, you know, that idea has been so lost. Like, everything has to be monetized.
But to that guy's credit, who we're talking about, the PR person, he's so on, like, that concept is so foreign to him, because being in tech and PR, like, people doing something for what would almost be an altruistic reason. But when we explain it to him like that, he's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I'm just not used to hearing that. And he goes,
I see. Okay.
He knows us. And I think, you know, what was interesting, and not to sound pretentious, what the level of skill, and this is also why the magazine came together, is the level of experience that people brought. They're all very, very senior people. And if you think of like the street value of the talent that worked on this magazine, we couldn't afford to make it if it wasn't for these people just doing it for, I mean, these are all people, I used to make a lot of money at one time or another in my life, but not anymore. But there was, a lot of people are all still in pretty good jobs and making pretty good money. And we couldn't afford, I don't know anybody that could afford this team if we hadn't done it the way we did it. If you look at, John, your example of blogs, if you think about, remember what, you know, Blue Martini and all those CMSs used to cost back in the day? They were like a, you know, it was right, like $1 million for a life.
ATG.
Yeah, ATG, all that stuff. And then, you know, after the dot-com bubble, it was like, how does free sound? You know, and every CMS, WordPress, movable type, you know.
But there were personal CMSs too. They were like small CMS for an individual to use.
As much as all those other ones, and they got them done. And then people just built them because they had time on their hands.
Yeah, they weren't even trying to make money. You can look at Matt Mullenweg. I mean, I think he's okay. He's got money, but he didn't put money first, was my experience anyway. And he still did okay. You know, you don't have to put money first. and you don't have to be greedy. But, you know, we got a lot of Gordon geckos in this world, and there's more today than there probably were a decade ago.
Yeah. I think I can say why I do it is that I validation. I want people to see stuff. I'm at the vanity of hearing, you know, like I love to hear when people have seen a piece, you know, and I like to quietly just listen and see if it's one that I did, you know.
Of course. Yeah, I love, you know, one of my favorite pieces is I think it was you and one of the art guys did the thread, that movie.
Yeah. Part.
Oh my God. When I saw that, I went nuts. Was that you and Troy together?
Yeah, that was one where I think Josh said, I like doing movie posters and we should just do, how about we do some movie? That was literally like the creative brief. If that's a lot how the magazine works. It's just like movie posters. And then Troy and I just, and Josh, we were just like, oh, you know, like movies. And you kind of combine the things like their love of, I love Saul Bass, all, you know, like we love movie posters. And we just kind of found a way to make, we were going to do three and we ended up just doing the two, but the thread, the conversation, I remember saying something like, you know, we should call it something, you know, like there was The Net, that movie with Sandra Bullock. And it was like, you know, it's got to be the thing. And I thought of the thread and you just think of like those, like a Twitter, you know, a Twitter thread that just won't end. And like, I think the original idea was like, I'd been kind of dealing with a Twitter addiction problem at one time, you know, and, you know, you write a post on Twitter and you cannot stop going back to look at, see if anybody's reacted to it. And there's no, you know, and then, you know, taking all that sick delight, you know, in it. And so that was kind of where the thought came from. Was,
you know, what also I think is great about the magazine, which is that there is this, and you don't often see this, there is a great consonance or something between the art guys who are very talented, but they're also smart and literate. And so they could contribute in certain ways that often art people, they don't really get what they're working on. It's just pretty pictures to them, but it doesn't register. And I was struck by that going throughout the magazine, is the art people really understood what they were working with. And, you know, the thread to me was just a classic example of that, you know, all the smart stuff was on the poster. I can't explain it, but often
Troy's brilliant. For me, I did some of the design of like the fake ads. Like I did the problematic, like that's 100% me. And I made that. But the thread was great because it was like all I really kind of contributed was the idea of like maybe calling it the thread and all that stuff. And maybe, you know, and then Troy took it from there and paid homage to the birds. And then he just took it and got all the, and this is what I like too, is the philosophy of the magazine too, is like all in for a penny and for a pound. Like if it doesn't look real, like it's a fail. And so Troy did such a great job of making it look like a real movie poster. And then the jokes inside that are jokes about movies. I mean, if you can actually read that skinny type and the credits and stuff like that, it just keeps.
It just keeps going. I mean, it was just like, there's no detail in the magazine that the deeper you look, the funnier it is, I guess I would say. That would sort of be my take. I don't know. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think designers, there's only two kinds. There's either ones that are just absolutely hysterical and the others that are just no sense of humor whatsoever.
Or so, I think it's ones that really understand what they're working with and ones that don't, you know, they can create pretty objects, but they don't really understand what the material is about. I can't explain it, but that's how I would bifurcate designers, actually.
Yeah. I mean, Troy knew what the assignment was when he was doing it, you know, and
yeah.
I mean, that what I described as minimal set of instructions, right? You're working with people that are so good at what they do. You just kind of, that was what the meetings were like. Somebody would just say something and then it would just turn into something.
That was great. I just want to say a little bit about my, you know, Dave and I've talked about it and I don't think it will happen, but you know, the Silicon Valley Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That
yes.
was my, I art directed that. And I said, David, print it on the crappiest printer, take it outside and step on it. Cause I want to like, it has totally no value. Nobody wants this disposable. But you know, he and I were sort of joking about, should we really do this? And you know, maybe there are a lot of people in tech that do want to self-flagellate and would pay a bunch of money for us to beat up on them. So I don't know. I don't know if it'll turn into a business model, but that was my one attempt at art direction, was that piece.
I thought it was great that you brought Sorry Watch in at the end too.
I don't, you know, I write things and I forget them. Sorry.
Well, the
Yeah, I'm
challenge of
sorry,
that
what should be
week,
in that? Yeah.
that's one I laid out because I tried to make it look like it was done. You know, we definitely wanted to make it look like they didn't have an art director,
That's right. And it was done
right?
overworked admin in an
Yeah, it
underfunded
has to look like it
office
was done in Word in a
and
template.
nobody cared about it. And, you know, all of that, we wanted to make it look as totally forgettable.
Well, and I wonder, that was probably the hardest part of that. I don't call it a joke. I mean, it's so much more than just a joke. But I think that from a humor standpoint, activating that concept of like, this conceptually is kind of funny in a snarky way that somebody would do this. And you're like, it seems plausible. But the other joke about how people probably would react to this thing is like, this altruistic group that really wanted to do this thing, and yet it's still something that everybody's like, eh, whatever.
Right, that's the point. And also the question you and David asked me, which I couldn't really answer, they said, is this serious or is this a joke? And I said, I don't really know. But
Yeah.
you know, it was fun for me. It wasn't just everybody I hated in tech, but I just felt like putting all those people together, like, you know, the law firms, the realtors in Palo Alto. I mean, it wasn't just the usual, like, let's pick on Andreessen, who's totally worthy of being picked on, but you know, it wasn't just them. So anyway, so
Who
we're
made the 1955 cover?
all those retro covers are fabulous.
Yeah,
That was Troy
that
and
particular one with
Josh.
the flying card. I saw a YouTube video yesterday of, I think it was Palmer Luckey climbing into a flying car and taking off.
Oh,
And it
perfect
was
for that
like, it was kind
part.
of like a drone with a seat for a person, you know. And it looked kind of similar to the one in this magazine cover.
Troy
Well,
is really, I think Troy really like made them real. And Josh and Troy and David Robinson and Alex Pirani, who we call Chef Alex, all were new to this go around. And Jeremy Lacroix, who we call Jerry Business. God, I really hope I'm not missing anybody. Margaret really like brought it together as like with a lot of like just small tweaks here and there and brought it professionally. They all have professional experience with real publications, but those, I love those retro covers. Those are really a team effort too, with like I threw out the line unsafe at any height. What is, you know, old to the old Ralph Nader unsafe, the Corvair thing. And so we just were like looking at the jokes were fun because it was riffing on what are the little headlines. Like I said, the was it $6 million man, we do the math. I mean, just that kind of little bits and pieces, because we had a lot of these like stray jokes that we would just say stuff. We had this huge Google Doc. We just didn't know where to go with them.
well, and
You
also
had all those
I love
little
that.
marginal bits that you stuck
Yeah.
in there, like, you
Right.
know,
And
like the one about the
every year,
Waymos.
in every issue, there was a joke about being worried about AI from 1955 on, which I thought was really great. So we're running out of time. So is there any last thing, John, you wanted to ask us?
Well, we have 6 minutes left.
Okay.
And one thing I could ask you is, I was reading the thing about, does it information want to be free? Or information wants to be free, right?
All right.
We could talk about that because I always, I mean, I had heard the original thing early on about where Stuart was really saying information sort of wants to be expensive, but it sort of wants to be free.
Right.
So there was more to it than just saying it wants to be free. And then everybody sort of took the free part and
That's
ran with
right.
it.
That's right. That's right. And I remember having an argument at Hotwired's offices in 1994, and I saw the magazine up on the Wired on the web, and I went, okay, not you in particular, but you in general, you've just destroyed the revenue model. And I've been ranting about this issue for, oh, I don't know, 30 years. So this is just my latest rant on the same thing. And all with the fights that are going on now with AI and copyright, it's just different iteration of the same thing. And I'm kind of bored of talking about it. So anyway,
Well, I mean, I do think it's kind of interesting to, I mean, it has come up in such a big way with AI. And the question is, so the AI isn't necessarily taking your work and making a copy of it and presenting that copy or selling that copy or whatever, but it's eating your work and regurgitating something that includes some aspect of it potentially, you know?
that's right.
So it's a different kind of situation, and I don't think copyright really addresses that very well.
Well, it doesn't, but I think the whole idea, and I've been ranting about this for years, the notion of authorship and attribution. And also one of the thing aspects of AI slop that drives me crazy is that it turns out what to create what I call MIGO, my eyes glaze over. Remember that term from the 70s? This kind of prose, which is actually dead on the page. And the idea that somebody could write something in such a way where you feel the distinct presence of a human, like just think of your favorite writer on stuff, that they have a distinct voice and you can feel the person behind it. And the fact that this kind of being awash in this AI slop, it's like that notion of that there's value in that voice or a particular human assembling stuff. I mean, I remember a gazillion years ago when I first read something by John McPhee, and I looked up and I'd realized I'd spent 40 minutes reading about oranges. And I thought, how did this happen? There's something in the way this human put this together that made it addictive and compelling and whatever. And AI just does not do that. But that idea is getting lost and I'm being a bore. So anyway, so I should shut up. And Brian, do you have any last question you want to ask Brian?
Well, or I could say, Brian, do you have any last words? Is there anything you can think of that we didn't cover?
No, I mean, my opinion on some of the stuff with the AI, and what bothers me is the situation I think where we're heading and have been for a while is we're just them that got is them that gets with copyright and stuff like that. We're in a really bad situation with all the worst players. It's kind of like the pandemic is that this bad situation happened and the worst possible people were in charge to handle the situation, and they're back again. And now, you know, money talks and the money's going to get what it wants. And I think with AI, I think the bigger problem we're going to have isn't all the world destroying. And you know, like we used to joke a lot in the magazine was we were promised a much more cooler apocalypse and what we're getting is kind of lame, you know. You know, like we were going to get Blade Runner, and now it feels like Home Improvement, the sitcom where I was sitting in the yard.
You know, one of my favorite comments, I'm sorry, I talk about this all the time, but it was so classic. Some AI founder twerp, and they're a dime a dozen in San Francisco. I don't even know what being an AI founder means anymore. And so he said, well, you know, AI is great and it will write the best novels and it'll write the best symphonies. And I thought, I bet you've never read a novel. I bet. And I bet you've never listen to a symphony. If you think AI could create something like what Prokofiev created for Alexander Nevsky working with Eisenstein, no, like he doesn't even know what he doesn't know. And I feel that all the time with these AI founders, they don't even know what they don't know, which maybe is a common.
Right. I mean, what AI has done is it's accelerated the devaluation of everything. And it's the absence. What I'm more concerned about is it's a lot like when CDs went away with MP3s, and right, because it was like, you know, you would try to explain to somebody like the artwork and shopping for records, and people would just be like, oh, that, you know, who gives a shit about that? This is free. And so the same thing with AI, where, you know, you can say something like, well, this used to cost $100 an hour to do, but now that it's pennies, the trade-off is so good, who cares what the result is, right? And then the idea that quality, you know, the stuff that we're whining about, you know, the essence or the voice or the human, that's all just, you know, been completely by the people that are making the most out of this stuff right now are people that never had a whole, like, they don't have any values anyhow. And it takes value.
That's true. And whenever you try to bring up the environmental impact of the stuff, which of course drives me crazy, the amount of water, the amount of power, all the rest of the stuff, they just kind of look at you blankly, you know, because generally my experience with these guys is they don't know anything about environmental stuff. They don't know their biology and they don't know their history. And so I sort of go, I'm just going to sit here and seethe. I'm sorry. I'll shut up. So anything else we can do for you?
Yeah.
Well, we'll solve the problem of the environment, I guess, in our next discussion. And
I'd leave you with this. I mean, the thing I think about the magazine is that we are not technology apologists. And it takes people who kind of know what this stuff is and what it can do to talk to the rest of the world, because the apologists are the ones that are going to do things like tell you it's something to be scared of and only they can fix it. And, you know, I think it really takes... I use the analogy, I was in a fraternity, and I think the stuff that people talk about with the Greek system and stuff is like, yeah, that's a problem. But you want to know the really horrible stuff, you have to have been in one.
Yeah.
Like, and know why it's like it is. And some things you think you're scared of aren't really anything going on.
That's right.
Be scared of is the stuff that they're like, that there are no grown-ups taking care of. Like there's, you know, talking about the search engine, you know, I've been in rooms with product managers and stuff like that who are just like, who cares? You know what I mean? You tell them stuff and they're just like, I don't care, move on. You know, like that's not, you know, this is about a deadline. Who cares if it's gonna, you know, result in, you know, microplastics in people's.
Let me ask you a question, Brian. I know that didn't David ship like 150 copies to Google's London AI lab or something? Didn't he do that?
He may have directly from the printer. I didn't.
Well, no, he probably from the printer. The point is, I want to know what those people at that lab thought of the magazine, and we haven't heard back. So I was really curious when he got that. We should ask him when he got that placement, because I thought, you know, I think it was put in the break room of whatever that facility is. What did those people think of it?
Yeah, that'd be interesting to hear.
Yeah.
Kind of makes me wonder too. Well, we are. Oh, go ahead, Wendy.
No, I was just going to say London is kind of different, I think. I think the sense of humor hasn't entirely left the building.
Has to be what?
I think the sense of humor has not entirely left the building.
Oh, yeah, like the English sensibility and just their sense of humor in general?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, humor may be all we've got to save us, really.
I don't think it's left here either. I just think that the guys that are making the most money being called comedians right now just happen to be the worst of them, just like in
yeah.
cash. You know, money doesn't equal popular. Money doesn't necessarily equal good, but it doesn't matter.
Hey, you know, Mad Magazine went away, but we have information.
That's right.
Mad didn't have ads either. Okay, we better stop it. Our hour's up, and we don't want to hold you guys any longer, but we hope you'll come back sometime, and thanks so much.
Well, thank you, guys.
And yeah, I do enjoy it. Great.
It was a great discussion. We'll see you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.